I have learned I need to shut my mouth on Facebook because, like, the Buddha will say, always eat your kale or something, you know.
I'm a Muslim and That's Okay presents some of the most interesting women I know.
Hi, everyone. May peace be on you all. And welcome to episode 3 of my special segment in which I interview some of the most interesting women I know. And today I have with me a very special guest. Her name is Natalie Cooley. I hope I've said that right, Natalie. I was like stressing out over your last name. I was like, I hope I don't mess this up. And I've known Natalie for quite a while now, and I'm pretty sure she gets irritated by me like more often than not, because I'm always going to her with random questions. And before
I love your random questions.
But before I tell you why I go to Natalie for my random questions, I'll have you, Natalie, give us like a brief intro about yourself, because I was reading your intro and I was like, I can't do this justice. Natalie, please introduce
I'm sorry.
Yourself.
I gave you an academic intro. I can't seem to help myself.
It was amazing, Natalie. So please tell my audience.
What can I say? So I've been academic, like that's my professional background. I had my PhD in cultural and historical studies of religion.
Wow.
On Buddhist communities, mostly in the United States. Most of my work has been with Sri Lankan American Buddhist communities in the U.S. I also do some work with Thai American Buddhist communities, and then also the predominantly white but increasingly diverse convert meditation Buddhist communities in the U.S. And then I've done some field work in Sri Lanka, which is a beautiful place, and I don't know if I'll ever be going back there.
I've heard it is. It's really amazing, but I've never been there, even though I grew up like really close to it, but you know.
Yeah. It's very hot.
Yes, Natalie. I know about the hot parts.
You know about the hot.
I know about the hot.
Yep, but a beautiful place. So. And that's where I did my dissertation field work. And, you know, I really like being in Buddhist studies. I'm in a great place for it because the Bay Area has people from Buddhists from all over the world.
That's why I go to Natalie. This is what Natalie doesn't know. And it started out, I'm going to do a flashback here, Natalie. I'm going to bore you a little. Okay. Yeah, I'm going to give you a little background about why I go to Natalie for my questions related to Buddhism. So, and like circa 1993, okay? I'm growing up in Pakistan, and we have, I guess you could call it history lessons, social studies lessons, whatever you want to call them. And I think it was the first time in my history book that I was introduced to Buddhism. And what it is, I think every person has, and it's different for every person, but every person has a sort of connection to ideologies. And that's a very innate connection. And please, nobody mistake it for a fact that it's something Islamic or Buddhist or anything. This is just my personal philosophy, and I have tons of them. But my philosophy is everybody has a connection to a certain ideology. The first time I had read about Buddhism in my history book, I was really drawn to the ideology of nonviolence, and especially when it, not just people, it also extended to animals. I've always had a soft spot for animals as well. But the thing is, even though I read it in history books in Pakistan, I was never really introduced to anybody who practiced Buddhism, either by chance. I mean, I'd met a lot of people who were Catholic, Christians, Hindus during my lifetime, but never somebody who was Buddhist. And, you know, fast forward 20 years and I met Natalie. And when I learned that she, in fact, practiced Buddhism, I sort of latched on to you, Natalie. That's what happened. And it's just that I always had the innate curiosity about Buddhism. And I was like, would I even ask? Because when it comes to Buddhism, unfortunately, all you have are some really bad pop cultural references. And yep. I mean, you got maybe one or two movies. Like I saw 7 years in Tibet, and when I look back at it now, I mean, at that time I was really drawn to it, but when I look back at it now, it's like, that's probably not a really good representation right there. And you know, all you have is like random quotes here and there by either Buddha or by the Dalai Lama. But again, it doesn't really reflect a very good totality of Buddhism. And that's when I met Natalie online, I was like, Natalie, you've got to help me out here. You've got to answer my questions. And that's how I turned to Natalie. And I mean, you've done some really extensive work. I mean, like you've just told us, even, and you told me you've co-written like 3 books. And I'm like, oh my God, I feel like so useless.
Well, that's what I get paid to do, right? So
still, I mean, Natalie, it's like, I can't even write one.
Well, it's hard work. But it's also really, really joyful. One of the things that you said about they're just big kind of pop references. Mm-hmm. I mean, so that's the terrain by being published in English that I'm sort of negotiating. Because what's interesting, particularly for Buddhists in the United States, is that a lot of academic works get read by Buddhists who are not academics, right, are interested in Buddhism. So there's kind of this dual audience that you have to keep in mind at all times. Well, you don't have to, but I think it's important. So for a few reasons. First of all, because a lot of the pop cultural references are not so much about Buddhism as they are about what non-Buddhist Westerners think Buddhism might be like.
Exactly.
And they do the same thing with Islam, right? they do things about what they think Islam might be like.
Right. And that's the thing. I mean, I think I know the disservice it does, and you know the disservice it does. Yep. And that's what I was sitting there before I was, you know, getting ready to interview you. And I was like, there are so many terms out there in pop culture that are direct reference to Buddhism, and yet people don't understand it well at all. And I was sitting there, and I was like, things like Nirvana.
Nirvana, it's an excellent example, right?
Yeah, and people don't fully understand what it means, but they do love using it. They love using the term. So you have the chance, Natalie. You have to clarify Nirvana and Zen, just because those are the two things like used to death.
Yeah. Well, you know, Nirvana, that's a Sanskrit word, right? So it's originally an Indian religion.
Right.
But it's a missionary religion. Mm-hmm. You know, like Native American traditions aren't missionary, so they don't go out and try to convert people. But Buddhists did try to go out and convert people. So a big chunk of Buddhism uses Sanskrit as a sacred language. And then a big chunk uses Pali. So Nirvana is the Sanskrit. You've got to stop me if I'm getting too technical.
Oh, no. I need you to say these things. I've studied the historical background of it, because that's how history was taught to me. I know that all of these things came from Sanskrit, but I know a lot of our audience does not. But it's important,
right?
Because most people would not even like root the origin of Buddhism to South India. But that is where it began, and that's a lot of the terms are sort of intermingled with Hinduism as well. Like
they're shared.
Yes,
because the Buddhist tradition arose in an Indian context, and they didn't say to them, "We're starting a new religion."
Right,
the youth is already there. These are the cultural building blocks, right? So a lot of the Sanskrit terms that you have in Hinduism overlap with Buddhist ones.
Right.
This idea of Nirvana was a little bit different because, well, what it literally means, and it's Nibbana in the southern tradition, in Theravada, in Pali, it means something like blowing out a candle. You think of it like that.
Oh, wow.
So traditionally, in kind of the orthodox doctrine, I mean, there are lots of ways to understand Nirvana, even among Buddhists, but kind of the orthodox understanding would be something like, so you're reborn and you're reborn and you're reborn, and that's not a good thing. You don't want to be reborn over and over.
Over and over.
It's not. It's samsara. It's like you're born, you get sick, you die.
Right.
You're born, you get sick, you die. You're born, you get sick, and it's just like over and over again. And the Buddha said, you know, there's a way out of this, right? Mm-hmm. So you could think of it as a flame being passed on a candle from right. one candle to another. That's how a life gets passed, right?
Right.
So if you learn the Buddhist teachings, you learn how to unlink that so that you've got it. And with that candle, you blow it out and you're done.
I see.
Then the question is, well, what does that, is that nihilism? Does right. that just mean that you're dead forever? Which is kind of the way, like, early Christians who encountered Buddhism, they were like, oh, that's just nihilism. That's right. just like soul suicide, basically. Mm-hmm. Not exactly what's going on. So the Buddha responds to questions about nirvana in right. some of the sutra, the Buddhist literature. He's very vague. Mm-hmm. And he says, you know, it's our concepts. Like, you can't understand it. No, it's not a place.
Right.
It's something, it's beyond samsara. It's right. something else.
Right.
And we can't talk about that. We can't. Like, there's right. language with us when we try to talk about those things. So, you know, he would say things like, people would ask him, does the Buddha exist after he dies and enters mm-hmm. nirvana? Does he not exist? Or does he both exist and not exist? All of the classically organized philosophical questions that you right. get out of the Indian traditions, which is delicious by itself. And he's like, no, I didn't teach you. I'm not teaching you about that. Like, right. I didn't come here to do that. And you can't even understand it. No, right. I'm just teaching you about suffering, which is dukkha, end of suffering. Okay, that's it. That's all I right. teach. I don't teach you about nirvana. I don't teach nirvana. That's not my goal. I right. teach suffering in the end.
Right.
So nirvana is largely a placeholder term that we don't understand.
And it that, means, that's the it's thing. Unfortunately, I'm only giving it from my perspective, that the way we sure. hear about it is that it's a place that you go at when you right. end the break the cycle. But right. that's then when I later on I was like, no, I don't think we're doing this right. You know, this is not what it is. I mean, and the thing is right. not like, since I'm not Buddhist, I don't fully understand it. But then I shouldn't be even using that term because it's not mine to use. That sort of thing. And right. the same thing with Zen. I think people, I think they sort of like mix it up with meditation plus yoga, but I think it again, I'm not the expert here.
Yes.
I don't yes. know exactly how to define it properly, so that's why I have you, Natalie.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So Zen is coming out of, so starts in India, right?
Mm-hmm.
We've got two main branches that we can talk about. There's one that goes up the Silk Route up into China, mm-hmm. and there's another goes to Sri Lanka.
Yeah.
Northern tradition goes through the Silk Road, all through Central Asia. There are all right. kinds of Buddhists. And into China. And then right. it developed in China. There right. developed this tradition called Chan. Mm-hmm. And Chan simply means meditation. Right. That's all it means. It comes from the word, from the Sanskrit word dhyana.
Mm-hmm.
Dhyana, just a kind of meditation.
Right.
So in Chan Buddhism, they were very heavily influenced by meditation. That's one of the misconceptions, I think, that a lot of people in the West in particular don't understand, mm-hmm. is that not all Buddhists meditate. In fact, most Buddhists do not meditate. These guys thought it was a big deal, right?
Right.
So they named the whole lineage after it. They named it Chan. And then as Chan moved into Japan,
right,
it turns into Zen. That's right. their... Zen is a translation of Chan, is a translation of Dhyana. Mm. So it means meditation, and it evolved into kind of a tradition that they're very antinomian, which is to say that like they like to turn social norms on their heads.
Right.
So, which is really fun. So things like when you see the Buddha, here's a saying from Zen, when you see the Buddha by the road, kill him. There's
wow.
right? Yeah. There are some really fantastic Zen stories because they say biographies. Their biographies are really big. So there's like a biography of a student being awakened because his master pushed him down the stairs. It's sometimes they're very brutal stories,
right,
but
right.
is kind of breaking our expectations and breaking social norms and using that to kind of jolt the mind. The goal is to see reality as it is, instead of seeing reality through all of our filters and perceptions and all of that stuff. The idea is to see it clearly,
right,
without all those all that other garbage on top.
Right.
So that tradition continued to develop in China and Japan and Korea and Vietnam. And it really became, in Japan in particular, highly institutionalized.
Mm-hmm.
And what we're talking about is monks who are meditating, and not even necessarily meditating all that much, but meditating.
Right.
And then their lay students who supported them. So much of the way that Buddhism was imported into the United States was based on the Orientalist notion
that Buddhism was
meditation, which it does not, right?
Mm-hmm.
Talk to a lot of people, even some Buddhists, they'll say, well, you know, you have to meditate if you're a Buddhist. And it's just absolutely false. So what a lot of people, a lot of lay people in particular, what they're looking to do in this life is not to reach nirvana, because that's a very lofty goal, right? Instead, what they're trying to do is improve their karma. And what that means...
There's another term that I wanted to ask you about, but let's... I'm happy to. I'll do that after you're done. Because the thing with karma was, I was not sure if it was like in Hindu tradition or in Buddhist tradition, or does it come in
both? It's in both.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
It's in both, and the Buddha made some... Well, let's talk about karma, because to even understand where I was going with that, you need to understand karma. The word itself just means action.
Right.
It's a very old term. Very old saying. It just means action, right?
Right.
Eventually, how that was being used in Vedic Hinduism was something akin to your action in the form of ritual offerings to the gods.
Mm-hmm.
And when you made offerings to the gods, that action brought consequences in the form of gods, whatever, being helpful in some way or another. And that's like in the Vedic fire rituals and these sorts of things. That's the understanding, is it's this sort of, it's ritual action, right?
Right.
So the Buddha tweaked that, and he said, no, it doesn't work that way. It's intention that matters. In the Vedic ritual, you could be thinking about whatever you're thinking about what you're going to make for dinner that night, or doing whatever. Like, it doesn't really matter, right?
Right.
It's there if the intention is there. It doesn't even matter if you believe in it or not. You just do it, and whatever.
Right.
No. Karma depends on intention.
Mm-hmm.
And what that, yeah, there's cause and effect. That's what the root of
That's what people understand
action,
it
right?
as. I mean, that's what the broader understanding is. Like, if
yeah.
you do good, you'll get good. And that's the like how people generally
right.
understand karma. But I was like,
right.
oh no, there's another thing that we've been messing around with that we have no idea what's
well,
going on.
It's, you know, I think the issue is that it's being decontextualized out of
right.
the larger system, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we could say, yes, karma is if you have the intention of doing something and you undertake a particular action,
mm-hmm.
there will be consequences. It's mechanical. I kick a soccer ball, it moves.
Right, right.
So Buddhism says there is a moral law to the universe.
Oh,
and
okay.
There's no creator God. Nobody created the moral. The moral law just exists in the same way that gravity exists.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a whole part of the universe. And
mm-hmm.
so when you do something mm-hmm. harmful, an intention first. So my intention is, I didn't like what she said about me last week, and so I'm going to embarrass her by bringing this up in front of her.
Mm-hmm.
To even have that intention
mm-hmm.
means that I brought up a lot of malice in my mind.
Right,
right.
right.
Yet the malice in my mind draws me to pain. That is samsara.
Right, right.
So so the Buddha says the mind follows, basically intention follows the mind like a wheel follows the those well-worn ruts in the road.
Right.
If we're cultivating these negative thoughts,
mm-hmm.
constantly cultivating behaviors that are harmful, that require negative intentions,
mm-hmm.
then we'll continue to be drawn into negative situations.
Right, right.
Right? So that's the unfolding. Now, karma can take place over much larger time periods than is being understood in kind of the outsider view.
Yeah, what we think it is. It's like an immediate thing. Oh, she was mean to me.
Right.
Mean's going to happen to her. That's not how that works.
Yeah. No. So in particularly in the Southern traditions, which is what I'm the most familiar with, that's Theravada, Vipassana, it's the stuff that comes out of Spirit Rock Meditation Center and those mainstream traditions. The understanding, at least traditionally, of karma has been, so okay, you bring these, the three root poisons, that's greed, hatred, and ignorance or delusion.
Right.
And when these things are cultivated in the mind,
right,
they're like magnets, they attract that. You're drawing it to you. So if I am constantly feeling jealousy and greed over other people's belongings, what's going to happen is when I'm reborn, my little flame is going to be drawn into circumstances in which the mind is looking for greed. So you may be reborn in a hell realm if you're cultivating like that.
And that's
it doesn't mean
it's so complex, Natalie. That's the thing that bothers me about this the most, that people use these terms, but they really don't understand how deep it goes. It's great flippancy to be able to just throw around things like karma or nirvana or any of those things without really understanding how big the context is.
Yeah, I really appreciate what you're saying about that. I think there are a couple of things going on, but one level of what you're saying, as I see it, is about cultural appropriation.
Exactly.
And so this is kind of one of the many qualities of colonialism that continues in our culture, is that we feel like Americans are trained to think we're the best and the smartest and we know...
I'll be blunt over here. It's not deliberate. And I only say this from the fact that I come from a country that was under heavy colonial rule. It's a tradition that unfortunately has been passed down for a long time. And again, it's one of those, I guess, cycles that is, you have to be very conscious of the damage. And most of the time, most people can't even see the damage because they don't see the broader context of it, of how me, somebody who is of South Asian background, knows English as a first language, and what should have been my first language is my second language because I was taught under the British system to have English as my first language.
Yep.
But most people don't really get the broader context of it because they won't even see the world to be that big, that sort of thing.
Yeah, I mean, more and more I see all of the connections between that colonial imperial project and in the moment ourselves right now. And we could talk about it as karma. Like, I don't think that would be terrible misuse of
You can do it. We have certain,
we have certain greed, hatred, and delusion, like the colonial project summarized, right? And those projects of dominating and exploiting other people, greed, complete delusion and ignorance about what that would cause in the long run. That has had its own trajectory that's been handed down through culture. So that what's happening is I'm inheriting those cultural attitudes from imperialists and I'm enacting them without even having the intention to do so.
Because
of ignorance. So I end up wearing a headdress, like a Native American headdress to Coachella because I think they're really cool and interesting.
Exactly.
And I don't reckon that's actually harmful to someone.
Right.
Or we throw around the word nirvana like we understand it. And we do that is to denigrate somebody else's religious tradition.
Exactly.
And trivialize it. And you may not mean it that way, but it doesn't mean it doesn't have that effect, right?
Exactly.
We have to, I mean, unlike karma in the Buddhist tradition, which says you have to have chaitana, you have to have intention, that's how it's going to color things. This is coming out of not so much an intention to harm, but just ignorance, pure ignorance.
That's the thing, an ignorance that is rooted in some very, I guess, prideful traditions. I and again, it's not just white colonialists. I see this in a lot of our, this is very universal, unfortunately, Natalie. I mean, I've seen it across cultures.
This is human nature, right? We're talking about human nature.
Right.
Yeah.
And so it's not exclusive to white people, but the impact it has is greater when, unfortunately, it's under the guise of actions of white people.
Well, the bottom line, the reality right now of the global systems that we're embedded in is that we're still feeling the effects of European colonialism and part of what the systems that were put in place. And systems don't require people that consciously enact oppression. It doesn't require that. Right. So we've created systems in which there is a racial hierarchy. And and you could say to yourself all you want, I'm colorblind or whatever. And still, if you're in those systems, you go somewhere like Sri Lanka, for example, the kind of colonialism that came there had real tangible effects
It still does, Natalie.
Yes.
I mean, there's a lot of colorism in South Asia. I mean, I know it because I have lived it. There is a preference for, unfortunately, the Caucasian race. It is a reality, and there's nobody who can deny that because that has been passed down generationally. Even in the systems, as you spoke of, I mean, I remember when I was growing up, we were like given English assignments to write letters. And what was taught to us in like second, third grade is like you end letters in your humble servant so-and-so. But that was sort of passed down from the British. And if you go to like government offices where they really aren't really taught a whole lot of English, but they will still use those terms, your humble servant, so and so.
Right, yeah.
So,
yeah. And that's how cultural traditions endure, right? Person to person to person. And that we could, I'm gonna come back to Buddhism, we can think of that as collective karma. Mm-hmm. And that's and has been very much overlooked in the West because Westerners have, by and large, particularly the United States, been trained to see things in terms of the individual.
Right.
An individual without recognizing that we're actually, you can't, there, that it's not true. It's false.
Right.
Like you have a community,
right.
Your community affects you and you don't exist in isolation. But if you look at particularly Southeast Asian Buddhisms, I don't want to talk so much about the Northern tradition. I'm less familiar with it, but there's a very strong notion of karma as being collectivist, being something that an entire culture is enacting. So for example, when the colonial, when the British colonial government was trying to and successfully eventually did invade Myanmar, there are all the effects of colonialism all around them, which are obviously really heinous and negative. And the thought is, well, this is our karma. We're receiving this because of things that happened in the past. And what can we do right now? Well, what we can do is come together as a group and purify our minds.
Right.
Because if purify our minds, then our intentions will be better.
Right.
And as a community, as a group, we will all move forward into better circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
And if we can look at that in terms of these sorts of oppressive systems that we're talking about, and I think that we can reclaim some of the social justice teachings of Buddhism that are lost. The United States has taken, like you've said, taken turns and taken ideas and turned them into things that are more comfortable, which everybody does. That's what happens with things.
And again, it's not exclusive to the United States, but
no, not at all.
It's just that the thing is, the impact of it is global because the thing is, that's the weird thing. Whatever starts in the U.S., it sort of like spreads as a trend, and that's where it causes the harm.
This is a fascinating aspect of Buddhism. Of Buddhist history, I should say, which is that, so imagine Sri Lanka, you're at the tail end of the 19th century. The British are there and they basically open the island up to a bunch of Christian missionaries who are coming and trying to convert everybody by saying that pagans, their Buddhists are pagan, heathen, and all this. So then enter in a number of people who, first of all, are interested in Buddhism as academics.
Mm-hmm.
So they're coming in and they have an understanding of Buddhism in a particular way. And then you've got these folks who are basically religious outliers.
right,
from America and Europe. So there's this guy named Colonel Olcott, an American, and he goes to Sri Lanka with his pal, Madame Blavatsky, and they say, we really like your Buddhism and we're going to convert. And they did. And they made a big deal out of it. And it was very public. And the Sri Lankan public really ate it up. The Sri Lankan Buddhist public really ate it up because it was like, see, we're not backward, even, you know, even the Americans. So they loved it. But what started to happen is those folks had a lot of power because they were American. Mm. And that dint of that gave them access to channels of power that were not available to Sri Lankans.
Right.
But they saying, like, we actually know what real Buddhism is. So God, the arrogance of this, I can barely even utter it. Let me teach you what real Buddhism is, people who have had this island for more than 2,000 years, but you don't really own it. I do. And so there were a lot of changes made to the Buddhist tradition.
Oh, wow.
And they were taken up, some by Sri Lanka, and then there was a lot of pushback. But then those ideas about what real Buddhism is, which was to say, oh, well, Buddhists say this, but they don't really understand. What they mean is this. Or the Buddha had these pure teachings, but, you know, the people who tried to practice it were just too dumb and they didn't really understand.
Oh, gosh.
So we're gonna figure out what the Buddha really taught. And we'll talk about that instead. You can't really rely on Buddhists to explain to you what Buddhism is because very dumb and ignorant, right? So then these ideas about what real Buddhism is, which was not real Buddhism. I hope you're still with me here. This is a long story.
No, I mean, I think...
they take this back to the West, right? And then you've got people who are, I mean, by and large, white people at this point, sit in Buddhism, don't know much about it, but all they have access to are these English language materials that are teaching what Buddhism is.
Right.
And they decide that they have the real Buddhism. So they become converts and they start writing books. And eventually we get to the 1960s, we have folks going to Asia and studying in Asia, but they already have these preconceived notions.
What it really is.
So they go there and they get what they want, which is the meditation tradition. And they bring them back and they say, yeah, we got the meditation traditions, which is what real Buddhism is, but we're getting rid of everything else because that stuff is just superstition. And then they write books about what real Buddhism is. And those books get circulated across the globe.
Right. So, oh, gosh. It's a huge mess, Natalie.
So Buddhists in Asia get these books that say, you're practicing it all wrong. This is what real Buddhism is. And they're like, oh, okay. This is what real Buddhism is. So even though the intention isn't to disrupt and harm, it is the effect because particular groups of people have more access to publishing industry.
To this, I guess, correct me if I'm wrong, it's pop culture Buddhism, basically, that sort of went, I'm sorry,
I can't tell you how many times I have learned I need to shut my mouth on Facebook because, like, the Buddha will say, always eat your kale or something, you know, like... Like, what are you talking about? But I never said that. But
there is no kale in South Asia.
just absurd stuff. Like, you know, be in the present moment and love your brothers and sisters, or just something inane. And I'm like, that's not, no.
Oh my gosh.
But the truth of the matter is, pop Buddhism then becomes real Buddhism, right?
Oh gosh. Yes. That's the thing. I mean, this is not even something that is exclusive to Buddhism. I see this happen in Muslim traditions as well. Right. I mean, it gets sort of like, I guess, separated from where it started out from. And then there's lots of, again, pop culture references that are like, no, you're not understanding this correctly. This is taking out, frustrating. Yeah, it's taken out of context. Yeah. So, yes. So, no, tell me, Natalie, and this, I've been meaning to ask you. So your parents were Buddhist as well?
No.
See, that's what I wanted to clarify.
My parents are post-Christian atheists, which is to say that raised Christian, but they didn't believe in Christianity. So by the time I was born, we're just straight up atheists. And the kind of sort of more of an old school atheism that was like, yeah, all those religious people are a little crazy, but we need to not be rude about it.
Right.
They kept it to themselves.
Right.
So to their horror, yeah. I mean, I was like, religion, they're horrified. They're horrified. Yeah, so my background is atheist, as far as my childhood religious upbringing.
Right, right.
And you know, that has some real issues. It makes it hard for me to join because back of my head, that's
trust
like,
me, Natalie, even when you're like from a religious family, like you could be practicing the same brand and you'd be like, but no, I don't, and then you can't even say I disagree with you. You're just like, it's better just to not like say anything at family gatherings. Just be quiet.
I'm just gonna nod and smile. That's what I do. Yeah. So I, you know, my parents have no idea what that's like. They're proud of me. They're nice people.
Right.
They're tolerant of the fact that I study Buddhism. But you know, I've sort of gotten to this point where like sometimes I'm like, yeah, I'm Buddhist. I'm hecka Buddhist. And then sometimes I'm like, am I Buddhist? I don't know. I don't know. It's complicated.
It can be, Natalie. I mean, there are lots of times when you're like, and especially when you're around people. I don't know about you, but for me, like, I'm around other people who are Muslim, really nice people, and you're like, okay, but there is something different here. Like, I'm sticking out like a sore thumb, and I'm not even sure why.
I feel that for sure. It's complicated. Religious identity, I've come to a place with that. Like people get into like what is real, who's a real Buddhist, who's a fake Buddhist, who's a real Muslim, who's a fake Muslim.
Exactly.
And
trust me, there's lots of people fighting. I don't know about people who are Buddhist, but there's lots of Muslim people who fight over these things. And it's like, die on
people take this stuff really seriously, right? But the way I'm coming at it, and this is definitely academic, and I will confess to that, it makes it a lot easier. It makes it easier for me, frankly.
Right.
Is that people are what they say they are.
Right, right.
They're Buddhist. They're Buddhist.
Right.
They may not have a great understanding of the history of Buddhism. They may not really understand texts.
Right.
They may practice vastly different than what I expect them to practice like,
right.
Or what other people practice like. But if they say they're Buddhist, to me, they're Buddhist.
Right. And
part of the reason I say that, we've had this discussion.
That's the thing. I mean, and that's when I turned to Natalie, because I think I was at a crossroads where I was like, and this is exclusively for extremists who consider themselves, who call themselves Muslims. And I was having a hard time dealing with this. And Natalie was like, if you cannot accept those who are extremists, and if I cannot accept them as Muslim, then I cannot fix the problem that is amongst a broader Muslim nation, I guess. That's how you had explained it. And that makes sense. I cannot, like, just because I don't like what they're doing, just like, no, they're not part of me. The fact is, they come from a tradition that is the same. It's just that their practices are harmful, like not even like harmful in a physical
right
harmful.
Yeah.
It's just as a harmful in a very broad context.
Yeah, you really put your finger on it. I mean, I really started to come around to that when I was hearing, particularly converts. It really bothers me when converts, because there's an inherited cultural arrogance that comes with
right, right.
And I've seen it in my own mind. I didn't ask for it, but I did receive it.
Mm-hmm.
People saying things like, you know, well, they're not really Buddhist. And it goes right back to Olcott, right? What we were talking about. And so that's the first level of it. I'm like, that's a problem. Like, you're labeling out of the Buddhist identity people that you think you're superior to, first of all. But the second level is Myanmar.
Yes.
So I'm so into this discussion, you don't even know. Like, I could talk all
I love it. I love it, Natalie.
The floodgates have opened. But looking at Myanmar in particular, right? So we've got, we could say the same in Sri Lanka, actually, that there's an anti-Muslim violence going on, really terrible anti-Muslim violence going on. And so there's this tendency for people to say, well, they're not really Buddhist, right?
Right, right. Again, if we cannot own what is wrong, we can't fix it.
We can't fix it. So if I'm, I mean, can I tell people, like, you're not really a Buddhist?
Right.
And they're just gonna say, yes, I am.
Yeah.
And then, like, we're nowhere. We have gotten absolutely nowhere. If you actually want to address harm, which is what you put your finger on, if you want to address harm, then you have to be open to seeing how one's own religious tradition can be used that way so that
exactly.
you can fix it.
Exactly.
And the only way to be able to fix it is through dialogue
right.
and putting your arms around and saying, come into my heart, come here
right.
and be here and let's work. And
that is so hard, Natalie. I mean, that is hard.
And
it's really hard. But I think, and that's the thing, that is how, I mean, anything worth doing is not easy ever.
Yeah.
So having to fix what is wrong will automatically not be easy.
It's pretty tough. And I mean, part of the issue is, I mean, at least from a Buddhist perspective, part of the issue is that humans are just human.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, like an atheist in my parents' tradition might say something like, well, religions are inherently evil.
Yeah.
And I'm like, no, that's not the issue. The issue is that humans do these things.
Humans,
whether they do it through governments,
right?
Whatever groups that humans create, they make oppressive systems.
That's the thing. It's about the groups. And that's why I've come to the conclusion as well that the problem is that we don't understand how to properly function in groups. Like, we create them and there's a purpose to them, but we don't function very well.
Yes. Yeah. Like this really strong desire to
dominate over be
domineering
or to be right all the time, Natalie. That's like,
I get sucked into that one big time. I get so sucked. I get into really dumb arguments where I realize that it's not even if I'm right, that's not the point of having discussions with people, is to be right. Like, I'll have to step away and be like, do I want to be right?
Right.
Or want to be compassionate?
That's right.
Like, I can't be both at the same time.
If you have a choice to be right or be kind, it's always a better idea to be kind, that sort of thing.
That's it. But, this is heavy, heavy stuff. And I think in Buddhist communities, particularly in the West, there has been this part of the historical context of disavowing certain Buddhists as being not really Buddhist is rooted in this colonialism that is still passed down through our culture. But I think there's a different dynamic underlying what's going on in Islam. And part of that I say from the gaze of the West, right? Mm-hmm. Oh, Islam is a violent religion.
The gaze Again, a lot of pop culture references, Natalie, that's how it is.
Same, right? It's the same thing that flipped on its head for Buddhism. The gaze, the Western gaze, is Buddhism is a peaceful religion.
Right.
And the Western gaze and the Western pop culture elevates that particular idea. Truth is that Buddhism is also a violent religion. It's also a peaceful religion.
Right.
Islam is also a peaceful religion because they're people, and people are violent and people are peaceful.
Right, right.
So if you look at the teachings themselves, you know, the teachings
and that's what I try to explain to people, and I have not had any major conflicts with people. But the thing is, what I've noticed in most faiths, and I'm not any scholar by any means, is that teachings are neutral. It's just people are not neutral. People can't be neutral because they have biases. That those are the biases that impact how they follow, whatever they follow. It doesn't matter what it is.
Yep, absolutely. So, I mean, one of the things that's why I keep pushing towards, particularly for Buddhists. When I have grad students, they come in with all of these ideas about what Buddhism really is. And then I also have a lot of grad students who are actually teachers in the Buddhist community because we have certificate programs. So I have basically like three different tracks of students. I have one track of students that they're just fulfilling their religion requirements, right. And they don't really care one way or the other. And they come in and they're like, isn't Buddhism a peaceful religion? And I'm like, no, it's not. And we've got the second kind of group of people who are Buddhist practitioners and ministers who are, Buddhism is a peaceful religion, and anybody else who says that it's not is not really Buddhist. Okay, so then I have to tell them they are Buddhist and you're wrong. And then I've got kind of the third group of people who are really academics of Buddhism, and they're like, well, yeah, of course they're Buddhist because, you know, it makes it easier for me to do my work if I just consider them all Buddhist. But it's really important for those first two groups to own that these Buddhists are not practicing the way that you think they should.
Right, right.
And it's because it goes back to colonialism in our case. Right. And I don't see that in the same, I mean, I think colonialism has a lot to do with, everything to do with kind of the extremism in Islam right now. But the way that colonialism is manifesting in the Buddhist tradition is kind of on its head, where Westerners have the gaze of it being a peaceful religion, but by doing that, they're actually harming and discounting huge swaths of the Buddhist population.
That's exactly right. And that's the thing, most people, I'm not the Buddhist here and I don't know about Buddhist tradition, but in every single part of the world, like in Japan, there is a different brand of Buddhism that does not coordinate with South Asian Buddhism. And as you had mentioned, in Northern China and even in other parts of the world, what the Buddhism is different traditions. And again, it has to be respected in its totality. So, I mean, just because you're a Buddhist in the West does not mean that you know all of these traditions and how they function.
It's been really interesting. So I've done a lot of work. I did field work in Sri Lanka, but mostly I did that because I really wanted to look at Buddhism in the United States. Mm-hmm. And you know, a lot of what we see in popular culture is coming out of convert Buddhism, right? It's that thing we were
talking about.
They have their views about what is real Buddhism, and then that's being disseminated the loudest because our Buddhist populations, for a huge chunk of our Buddhist populations in the U.S. are refugee populations, Khmer, Vietnamese, people who came from South Asia, and their views and attitudes and practices and beliefs are really not represented in popular
culture. That's right.
And they're discounted, really. And what ends up happening is they're sort of in a double bind where they're not really Buddhist, but they're also not really American.
I know.
It's very deep. It's a very deep, and I am going to say white supremacist. That is white supremacy, because if you're not white, you're not American. And it's an assumption that a lot of white folks have, and it's not based in a mean intention. I've been the person who said, where are you from? No, where are you really from? Mm-hmm. Right. No, I understand. Well, yeah, you were born in New York, but where are you really from? Right. That's that attitude. My husband, he's so gracious about this, but very firm. People will say, where are you from? He's like, Pennsylvania. I say, where are you? And he'll say, where are you from? And they'll be like, I'm from California. No, but where are you really from?
Oh, gosh, right? The number of times I've heard that question, Natalie.
I bet you have, but that's the double bind, right? Yeah. You can't be really Buddhist. That's what I spend a lot, like, that's what I do a lot of my work with, is because since I've been exposed wonderfully, beautifully to particularly Thai and Sri Lankan Buddhism, the way that it's been presented as not really American,
right,
not really Buddhist, like it's a double whammy, a double loss. So in my classes, I am one of those awful professors. I get this in the responses from students at the end.
Student evals, yeah.
Yeah, I'm not doing it. I'm not doing the little nice version of Buddhism. I'm not going to get, you know, the palatable American versions of Buddhism. I'm going to force them to think about rebirth.
Right. Merit. But you're fighting the good fight, Natalie. I mean, it's high time, because people should not be now holding on to what they've been holding on to for so long. I mean, if they really want to, I mean, they shouldn't be, first of all, using any of the terms, like, please don't use Zen, don't use Nirvana, don't use karma. You don't know what it means. Just stop.
Talk about the Zen of motorcycles or the Zen of anything. Stop talking about this. Stop it.
Stop. Like, it's terrible because, and I get it, because sometimes when you're a minority, you wish to see some part of yourself reflected somewhere. But if it doesn't serve a better, greater purpose, then it's no good at some point. If it it furthers a misunderstanding, it's no good.
I totally agree. And to be very one-minded about the whole thing, because what I was trying to talk about earlier in this conversation,
we got sidetracked. I'm sorry, Natalie.
I could go off in 50 directions, but we were talking about karma,
right,
specifically, and rebirth, right?
Right.
The things that convert American Buddhists have a very hard time with merit. And merit is a central practice in self.
Right.
Which is that you do good things with good intentions this life.
Right.
And it brings you a better rebirth.
Right.
That's merit practice. So there are tons of practices that are not meditation, but that are bound up with the idea of merit. So taking care of your parents,
right?
So giving alms to not just monastics, although mostly monastics, but also to the poor, or making a moral behavior with the intention to do good in the world.
Right.
That is a central Buddhist practice that's being lost here in the United States. So that's one of the things that I teach, that I make a cornerstone of my course, is merit practice, because it's been denigrated as superstitious.
And that's what I was introduced to when I was reading it in history. And I thought that that had to be like integral. I mean, it doesn't matter what else changes, but I would think that that was there. Again, I'm not the expert here, but that's how I had read it.
Yeah. Well, once you start pulling that out of the whole logical, like the whole worldview, which is that we're reborn and that there are different realms you can visit, all of that stuff. Once you take that out of the picture and you just start pulling out pieces and being like, I just want this piece.
Right.
That older system is going to fall apart. So that people start seeing karma as, you know, you ran into somebody's car yesterday, so you're gonna get your
it's an immediate thing. It's like instant gratification karma. I'm sorry.
Absolutely. But that is it. It is that mind of instead of looking at things. And I think this is something that we could learn from these more traditional Buddhist practices.
Right.
That if you stop looking at it as me and mine and what I'm going to get, and start looking at it as a community,
collective,
we can use merit as a way to plant seeds of good.
Right.
But not in my lifetime.
Right.
Maybe not in my kids' lifetimes, but in other lifetimes.
Right.
And that's one of the benefits of thinking, of trying on traditional Buddhist thought, even if we can't buy into the whole idea that there are multiple realms of existence.
Right.
We're born. We can understand that we have generations of kids who are born.
Right.
And then cultivating good.
Right.
So that we're doing climate change not because I benefit from it, but because
at least my kids get to breathe fresh air. My grandkids get to breathe fresh air. It's that sort of thing. Oh my God, Natalie, I could go on forever with you, and you know that. You know, we could go on forever, but before I let you go, Natalie, you know, it's part of the shtick. You know, you've got to play the rapid fire round, okay? And unfortunately, it's not related to Buddhism or as deep as your conversation.
That's okay.
But in the rapid fire question round, I'll ask you 5 questions, okay? And you have to give me the first thing that pops into your head. I mean, you can think about it. So,
Bring it on.
So,
No
thinking at all. So, sushi or avocado toast?
Sushi. I don't like avocado toast.
Okay. Batman or Superman?
Oh, jeez. Batman's more of a bad boy, so I guess I like him better.
Okay. All right. Pepsi or Coke?
Coke.
Okay. Do you call it a GIF file or a JIF file?
GIF.
Natalie. You almost had me, Natalie. Okay. So when on your French fries, do you have the ketchup on the side or on top?
Oh, the side.
Yay. We're friends again, Natalie.
I must control the ketchup. That's
yes.
why.
Thank you so much, Natalie. I mean, it was a pleasure talking to you. And we could go on for hours. And, you know, I hope that everybody who's listening gets at least a little bit of a deeper understanding of what I try to get from you, like every few weeks, you know. Natalie, help me. I don't know, understand. What
I love your questions.
And, you know, it's all about respect, Natalie. I think in this day and age, in the climate that we're in, I think it's so essential to just, I mean, we grew up with a lot of really weird belief system, but I think it's high time that we moved on to something better, to a place where we can all be better for one another. And for that, I'm so grateful for you and that you're part of my life and one of the special women I know. And I hope to see you guys next episode in a couple of weeks. Until then, take care of yourselves and may peace be on you all.